one thing to understand about me right now is that I didn't sleep for 2 days, essentially, before Alan got here. And then Alan had accidentally taken a... He was trying to do a shortcut, and it ended up, like, doubling his fucking drive from, like, whatever it was, like, Oregon or whatever. And, like, and he had, you know, Jeremy and Melissa, and they just... It was, like, he arrived... like he was supposed to arrive at night on, what was it, Friday night, and then it was like Saturday, you know, like around 2 p.m. or something, he showed up, and so we stayed up as late as we could, and then I drove Jeremy to the airport to go back to France in the morning, at fucking early, and so and I haven't slept since. So I'm just like in a super spacey place, and so it might not be ideal for a show, but I was just so fucking excited over the stuff that I've been looking at. I'm just like, I want to tell someone about this because this is fucking crazy. So
you are listening to Always Record from thesyncbook.com.
So, yeah, I've been, obsessing on, The Visitor as of just recently. So, I don't know if you ever got the chance to see that. I forget the other title. It's like Stridium or some weird thing. You know what I'm talking about?
Elaborate.
It's like this really weird culty movie about, this girl who's basically, like, it's the devil and Jesus basically fighting for the soul of this girl. And she's evil, but she's being attempted to be turned into good.
Did and you say it was like Rosemary's Baby?
It is.
Is this the movie that was like it?
It has a lot of correspondences to Rosemary's Baby and The Omen and a little bit of Star Wars. But this... Okay, I'm going to go to my Facebook so I can bring up my notes. Just fucking insanity sauce to the max today. I'm working on this thing, and it's blowing my mind in the first place. So basically, this sounds weird, but a lot of things sound weird. There's a album by ABBA called, The Visitors. And it came out shortly after the film The Visitor came out. And, it parallels the film, like, incredibly well. But then there was all these, like, things that it was, like, I was taking from it symbolically. And so I was like, something is fucking up with this movie. I'm like, this movie is fucking charged, like, on a crazy energetic level. I'm like, what the fuck is up with this thing? Like, I started researching a little bit. And, like, right away, I'm like, okay, what happened on the release date of the film in the U.S.? One of the biggest fires to happen in a hotel, it was the second biggest hotel fire in U.S. history, happened on the day and year that this film came out, and it was the MGM Grand in Nevada, in a place called Paradise. So the place is Paradise, Nevada. But then I'm like, fucking Paradise, and it struck me, I'm like, I saw that name in the credits. So I go to the beginning credits, and there's two writers of the screenplay, and one of the writers' names, what he goes by, it doesn't seem to be his real name. It's like what he does for, like, American audiences, but it's in the title of the film, is Michael Paradise. Paradise is his fucking last name. And so this, on the day that his film was released, in Paradise, Nevada, at the MGM Grand, there's this giant fucking fire, and all these people die. And so I'm like, okay, well, that's weird in the first place. But then I look up a news broadcast of it, and in the news broadcast, the last thing they say is this is the second biggest fire, second only to this place. Give me one second here. Okay. So in Atlanta, the Weinkoff, Weinecoff Hotel. That was the biggest fire that's happened in the U.S. in a hotel. But what's fucking... I'm like, dude, Atlanta? I'm like, the movie's filmed in Atlanta. There's like a little opening sequence where this Obi-Wan character connects with this girl. But then the next, very next shot is this fucking giant hotel in Atlanta that says something like... Okay, it's called Equitable. It says Equitable on the building. But there's a shot, and it says across the bottom of the screen, all of a sudden, it's like Atlanta, Georgia. And it's like zooming out on this aerial shot. But in the aerial shot is the fucking hotel that the biggest fire in U.S. history ever happened. In the film. You know what I'm saying? So the fucking day the movie comes out, there's the fucking second biggest fire in a hotel in the U.S. And it happens, like... What the fuck?
That's pretty nuts.
Yeah, man. That's what I'm saying. It's totally nuts.
So that's what you're chasing right now?
Yeah, well, it's just like... And it's an experiential thing, so it's hard to translate. But my process for leading me to that was this sync with Abba, which is Hebrew, which means father. The name Abba. People say Abba, but I guess Abba. I don't know. That they came out with an album called The Visitors. It's just like, and I'm like, The Visitors? The Visitor. Okay. You started at the fucking 42-second mark, and it's incredible. It's fucking bananas, to quote Will Morgan.
Well, speaking of like Will Morgan and whatnot, how was the Sync Summit for you? And what was, like, the highlight or a number of highlights, and how did your presentation go and so on, if people might be interested?
Yeah, totally. Well, when the video comes out, there's probably going to be a little walkthrough. I mean, it was such a plain picture. I mean, we kept on looking at each other. You know, I'm sitting next to Ezra, and I'm just like, oh, my God, dude, this is ridiculous. So right off the bat, Ezra does a presentation talking about Philip K. Dick's thing with the zebra, right, from Valis. And so he's making this connection. It's the first thing that happens in Radio 8 Ball. So we're doing the Radio 8 Ball show. He brings up the zebra thing. And I mean, I'm looking at it and I can't help. I'm like, the giant Radio 8 Ball wheel itself is black and white stripes. You know, it's like a zebra. And then fucking, there's a number of things that happen, but just to try and sum it up, Jeremy goes up and he happens to be wearing a shirt with Charles Manson on it. And it says, Charlie, don't surf. Which is an Apocalypse Now reference, which is clever on multiple levels, especially like Apocalypse Now, you know, Helter Skelter. But then it's like, you know, that's Charlie's point, and Charlie don't surf, but Charlie Manson wrote songs for the Beach Boys, you know, and he didn't surf, so it's funny. But it's black and white. He goes up wearing this black and white shirt, and it's random, you know, they're picking the things from the box. There's a ton of fucking people there who put in questions into the Radio 8 Ball box. So he happens to go up. I'm not going to go into the specifics around what everybody's questions were in the songs, because you'll see that when you see that. But, you know, he's up there. And then this, I feel bad because I don't remember her name, but they're awesome. There's a woman who is pregnant who went up, and she, I'll say her question. She asked, is it a boy or a girl? And there was, I mean, there's a number of things I could say, but I'll say the thing that stood out was that, I mean, we couldn't deny it. Everybody heard it. It was like the song was talking about stillbirth. It was talking about basically the baby's born at death. It says that in the lyrics of the fucking song for Radio 8 Ball. You know, Radio 8 Ball works, you know, that you're taking, someone asks a question and then the song is giving you your answer, but the song is completely random and whose question gets asked is random. And so that fucking happened. And this happened, the day that we're doing this is the day that the anniversary of the Abbey Road photograph. And so ultimately it's within, you know, a 24-hour period, well, much less than that, of Sharon Tate's death, when the Abbey Road photograph was taken, which is them crossing a zebra crossing. So, like, they're crossing a zebra crossing. Sharon Tate gets killed on a zebra rug. I don't know if you knew that. The zebra rug in the middle of the floor. You've seen pictures. Anyway, so zebra, zebra, zebra. and fucking, you know, that's pretty heavy. I mean, we're looking at sync and symbolicness and hopes and fears, and what you hope for, you also fear, and what you fear, you also hope for, you know, that's generally the nature of things. And it's reflection, and it's, you know, everything comes out. But it was like, whoa. And so there's, at the end of it, you know, Andras is going through and he's reading all the questions that didn't get asked, the people who didn't go up, as they're playing a song, and he's just going, flipping through, and there's a ton of questions. And when he gets to the last question, he's like, this is the last question, holds it up in the air, it's probably important. He says that, and then he reads it, and it's like, the question is, why is Zebra such a dick? Which was fucking bananas, right? But then Will Morgan shows up later that night, and we're walking to the, you know, the Olympia Tree of Life, which is incredible, by the way. It's awesome. It's super overt, Masonic deal. And we tell him about this, and I give him the walkthrough like I'm doing with you right now, and it's because he didn't catch Radio 8 Ball, and so I'm telling him. And he's like, dude, that's my fucking presentation. Because he's focusing on horse, the etymology of horse being the phallus. So the horse and dick are like the same thing etymologically. So you look at a horse, the way that they wanted to communicate what a horse is, that's how they did it. But
his character in Valis is Horse Lover Fat. I think that was his name.
Yeah, exactly, which is what Subliminal Synchrosphere goes by. But Valis Phallus. It was just like, it was a total mind fuck. It was like, I mean, what do you expect when you get a bunch of synchronicity folks together? Like, this shit fucking happens. And like, we're all just like, really? Really? Like, I'm like, I'm not doing this. We're not like, we're not orchestrating this. This is just what's happening. And it totally was happening. It was crazy. And then later on, the next day, we go to eat dinner together at in this place. What was it called? I can't remember. Dillinger's. You know, Dillinger was a bank robber or something. I'm not educated. I don't know. Basically, we go into this bank vault, and there's a giant zebra rug in the middle of the room. In this bank vault, and then the table is also zebra print. The fucking zebra room. What the fuck?
So, have you looked much into Philip K. Dick? Since I know it's not your thing necessarily.
I read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep a number of years ago. I really enjoyed it. I haven't read Valis. I read A Scanner Darkly.
You have some acquaintance, and that's like enough to a degree, but like, he was so fucking out there in like Valis, the Valis trilogy, and I loved it, and like, I think it inspired a lot of people. Like, Neil Kramer, I think, was the first person I heard talk about it, and so I dug into it. It's just, it's interesting that actually the science that I started investigating most of all was because Philip K. Dick talked about it in such an odd way in his book that I thought it was very interesting, but pointed in the right direction. I just kind of had a intuitive feel about it. He was projecting about like information theory and general systems theory. He was a science fiction writer, so I would expect him to have some acquaintance with like the theories of his time. But he was ahead of his time in putting them as prime elements of his kind of, you could say, his, I don't even know what to call it. I don't think he was trying to make a religion at all. But I mean, like, his philosophy is inherently, he sees human beings as like information processing machines. But he never called humans robots. He just said we're kind of like information gathering creatures, and that's what we're here to do, is to refine that information. Anyway, so he was just in touch with a lot of stuff, I feel, like well beyond what Blade Runner or Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep pointed at, because AI is interesting, but I think his stuff goes way beyond AI that people don't appreciate, or because they think Valis is kind of like a mirage in his work or something, but I think it's actually the best, and I think certain people think it's the best. But anyway, I think you would find some crazy stuff in Dick's work.
Yeah, I've been meaning to get into it. I have a friend who gave me a Philip K. Dick book my last birthday that I haven't gotten into, but I've been meaning to. It's the man whose teeth were all alike. You ever heard of that one? I mean, he's pretty prolific. He wrote a lot of stuff. So
I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah, well, anyways, I was going to check that out.
What's it about?
I don't know. I haven't gotten into it yet.
Okay, the name is just interesting alone. Yeah, he's right? Done, like, dude, even his, like, exegesis is so vast. It filled a fucking garage, I think, of, like, I mean, the guy wrote. I mean, it was just, like, I feel it was a cathartic, I think that's the word, experience, where it was just kind of, like, his release was his writing.
Yeah.
And he was just feverish about it, especially after his visions and whatnot. But anyway, I liken him to a shaman, and I like investigating him because it's like, what is a person going through something of a more intense shamanic experience than a typical person? Like, what is it like? And I feel like he's a good example. He wasn't just a schizophrenic or something.
He was neurotic, from what I gather.
Just neurotic as hell. He had like 7 wives. He had so many wives. Like, I don't think he could get along with anybody, ultimately. He was like very... He was all over the place in a certain sense, but later in life, I heard that he became more like centered based on this experience and whatnot.
Oh, really? But, I heard he went fucking crazy, like he got crazier okay. and crazier, and like,
well,
like his last.
I'd
stuff
say manic.
Like, okay.
I don't want to say insane. I would say manic. I think there's a difference, but I could be wrong.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, somebody who was really into Philip K. Dick told me at that one point that like his last stuff is just like. But who knows? I mean, I show my videos to certain friends, and they're just like, they, one in particular recently, was just, he must have said, "You're crazy," fucking 50 times in the course of the night. So I'm just like, well, okay. Like, like, what am I supposed to, I don't know. This is what I'm immersed in. I don't know what to tell you, you know.
There's so many ways to get at good information or some kind of like I don't know, some kind of abstraction that hints at a deeper reality. They're scattered all over the place, and we can all investigate different things, and I think crazy is like kind of a silly label on a lot of stuff. Certain things I'm still willing to call crazy, but
I have to read it to know, to get the idea, right. I mean, to infer like where he was at.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't trust like Western definite labels of like what is crazy or what isn't anymore and like whatnot. So I love people that go in different directions. And like, I think, you know, so what you do and like, you know, Dick himself just was like in a whole crazy different direction by the end, which I like. But some people have criticism that that stuff was shitty and like he was just crazy. But I think the opposite, that he was never been saner, actually.
Yeah.
Maybe crazy in terms of just like we said, he's manic and he was like doing that, all the writing. And I guess anyone that feels like they're possessed by an experience is going to probably vent,
yeah,
or maybe vent that way.
I don't know. I didn't mean to necessarily make a thing out of that because I don't even care, really.
Oh, no, it's not. No. I don't think like you're defending that. I'm just saying like that's my view on it, just as someone that's like, I don't know.
So,
thought about that subject a lot.
Yeah, so I manically worked for 2 days on a project before Alan and Jeremy from France and Melissa, Alan's
Jeremy's
wife.
JJ, right?
JJ Draw, yeah. And Joe Alexander came over, and it was great. We shot the shit. We hung out. You know, Jeremy got to talk to my rabbi, which was cool. Got to meet him, which is nice. But I had been working on this project where I was taking, I took, it's up right now, I took Full Metal Jacket, The Shining, and Eyes Wide Shut, and I superimposed them all together. Oh, and Lucifer Rising, which comes in when Full Metal Jacket ends. And I've been working on the music side of it for a long time now, a really long time, a few years actually. And so that thing came together and it's out there, and it's out there and it's out there. So, I don't know. It kind of, there's certain things that like, I mean, I knew about those films, but I didn't, until you see them simultaneously, it's not as overt. certain aspects of it. It's a lot to go into. But one major thing I would express is that if you look at those three films, they all have the same theme. I mean, all Kubrick stuff relatively has the same theme. But the neurotic side of it is definitely, like, really obvious. Because you can see, like, you know, Bill in Eyes Wide Shut, you know, his wife, everyone knows the plot of Eyes Wide Shut, his wife reveals to him that she was willing to leave their marriage for one night with this guy, who's that into the sailor that she happened to glance at, which sends him on this whole, like, crazy thing where you're looking at his own repression and his own frustration with his repression and, like, his processing. But if you're looking at it with Jack, and you see Jack becoming more and more neurotic as the film goes on, it looks as though it's, like, simultaneously, like, what's happening inside of Bill, or what's happening in Jack could be what's happening with Bill. But then, with Full Metal Jacket, you know, you got Pyle, who's going more and more, you know, off the deep end, but he's resisting the programming, and then he embraces the programming, and then you have, you know, Joker and this whole thing of losing innocence, I guess, and we have seen the enemy, and it is us. It's, you know, the whole thing with the Full Metal Jacket, you know, I mean, that was like a phone call. I saw this in the Vanity Fair article where Kubrick calls this guy, who's, what is he, the head of Warner Brothers, I think. I mean, these are all Warner Brothers films, so yeah. And he, or I don't know if he was the head of Warner Brothers or what he was doing, if he was the producer of Eyes Wide Shut. Do you know the guy who wrote the Vanity Fair article?
It sounds familiar.
Anyway, so he goes to this guy, and he's just like, are you familiar with Jung's idea of the shadow? And he's like, you know, have you read Jung? And he's like, because I want to make a movie about that. And he's like, do you know of any good war books? And that's how Full Metal Jacket came to be, was the subtext first, the everything else secondary to that. And so when you watch all of those films, you can see that he keeps playing on that same point. It's like, it's all psychoanalysis. All those films are like, as if they were in one person's mind, psychoanalyzing the different layers of his own sublimation and issues, you know. It's like, it's all like a processing endeavor or something. So,
right. Yeah. I think we mentioned that before, but it's like, yeah, it's so obvious that he's just kind of like, yeah, it's an, yeah, self-evaluation largely, especially when it comes to The Shining. I mean, it's like pretty overt with the insertion of the Minotaur's maze into that movie, which was not in the book, and when it is clearly a reference to self-exploration and like confronting your demons and then coming out maybe more enlightened or never escaping, one or the other. And then, you know, it's this hotel on a mountain that's like, you know, the Golden Eye. It's got all this stuff. It's pretty obvious. I don't know if you're like, I'm not even that well versed in this stuff, and it's pretty obvious to me.
You know, and I'm trying to remember this, and I can't remember if in the book of The Shining, if the fucking hotel burns down at the end.
Oh, you know, I'm not sure. I wouldn't be surprised, because like he changed a lot.
Yeah, I don't have the book here. I'm really curious about that, because I was trying to. There's all these different things from the book, though. I mean, I remember the hedges came to life or something.
I'll Google it. We'll see what turns up. So.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, I know it was partially it was inspired by a lot of things, but there's something, the Blue Hotel. You know that? There's a book called The Blue Hotel that supposedly.
Maybe it sounds familiar, vaguely familiar, but not well acquainted by any means.
I don't know. This is the thing. I'm recording for a radio program, and I'm just like, is this what it is? I'm not very professional.
It's like whatever.
People can. It's good though, because you know I'm putting it out there, and if it turns out, I mean, I'm not saying that it's the case, but that would be really interesting. Yeah, no, I don't know. I decided, it's weird because I was looking for a title, And what came to my mind is I was just like, the whole time I'm fucking working on this, I'm thinking about how Mark LeClaire would appreciate it. I'm like, Mark LeClaire would fucking love this. I mean, I'm not absolutely positive of that, but I'd say I'm 95% sure that this would be, like, awesome for him. And so I called it A Dream Story for Mark LeClaire, because Eyes Wide Shut, the book, was called Dream Story, you know. And so to relate to the whole thing as a dream, the way that dreams are like, you know, they're an overlapping synchro mesh of information. And so I was, or like somebody going deep into psychoanalysis, which is essentially going into dream symbols and getting things communicated on levels that they're normally not in touch with.
Yeah, definitely. The Shining book, the hotel does burn down.
It does.
It does. At least from the quotes I'm reading on this Google search. So it's the internet. It's open to being false, but...
Well, no, I mean, I heard that. So I felt like I heard that. And so when I read that book years ago, I wasn't in a receptive place. I retained so little from it. I don't know. I didn't read it properly. I don't even know if I sat down and read it with a bookmark. You know, I think it was like more of like a sporadic thing. And I read over parts that I had read before, and it was a scattered reading. I don't know if you ever do that. I do that sometimes.
It depends on what it is. If I care very little about it, I tend to do that. And I also don't read fiction. Like, I'm pretty bad about reading fiction. I should start doing it. I'm sure it would open up.
Yeah, I can relate. I read a lot less fiction. That's true. But
I read so much nonfiction that is like fiction, that it's almost like, what's the point of like indulging in fantasy when like my nonfiction world is almost like fantastical in a way.
I haven't even really finished a Stephen King book, because every time I read a Stephen King book, I don't care for his writing. And so, like, I'm interested because I'm interested in getting the, you know, any book that I'm reading, I've seen the film before when it comes to Stephen King. And so, you know, I mean, most of his books are actually better than the films. Shining is definitely an extreme exception, even though he stated that that's his least favorite of all the movies that have been made from his books. I'm like, what the fuck, yeah. Dude? Langoliers? Like, you gotta be kidding me, dude.
Langoliers, it's so horrible. I mean, it's horrible in that it's so bad it's good kind of thing, because it's so fucking cheesy, because the Langoliers get, oh my god, what was that done in like 95, and they're just starting to play with like CG, and it was really so bad.
No, there's so many bad Stephen King movies, that's what I'm saying. It's the only reason it's his least favorite is because it's the least like what he wrote.
Yes,
and then he didn't try and stick to it, and he raped his fucking book. To quote Alejandro Jodorowsky talking about Dune, he was like, "You have to, you know, you have to take the book and you have to rape it." And he was like, "But with love." So he's like, "It's like the man who gets married and then basically rapes his wife, but he loves her." That was
oh my god. So, okay.
Yeah.
All right, just kind of like sharply transitioning. All right, Friday night was Radio 8 Ball, and Saturday was all the presentations, right?
Yes.
And then, like, okay. And so how many people presented, and kind of like when did you start, and what order did it go in, and did everyone get their shit done?
Everyone got their shit done except for me and except for Joe. But Joe showed his... I mean, I showed a video at the end of the night. There was very few people in the room by the end of it, and it wasn't even the end of it, you know. I went halfway through and then I turned it off. But it was just so fucking late, and people had been just sitting for so long, and it was super understandable. And so, you know, it was frustrating, but at the same time, I understood. And then Joe showed his video, and people took it in this room. So we left the venue, and we went to a space where there was a television. And... So, I mean, it was what it was at the end there, but we got shut down, not early necessarily, but, you know, we wanted to go later there, and it didn't work out. But what are you going to do? You know, I mean, that's not the thing to focus on. The thing to focus on is the fact that many presenters went up, and people took it in. They were all amazing. Every one of them was amazing. It was awesome. Asher, what's his name? 237?
Rodney Asher.
He did a Skype interview. He was going to show up, but he didn't show up. He did a Skype interview, showed his film. That was rad. I don't want to single people out because there's so many, and I don't want to leave anybody out. It was incredible.
Well, who kicked things off, I guess? Who's the first person to go?
Well, I guess technically the first person to go was Andras, because we walked the whole Tree of Life in Olympia, it was overt. It was really clear. I mean, I could just see it. I mean, we crossed the street to go over the abyss and went, to the Supernal Triad, which was around a lake. We circled the whole lake, and it was awesome. I'd probably have difficulty going through one by one because, like I said, I don't want to leave anybody out, and they were all amazing. So.
Okay. So, well, I know Joe worked on his video for quite a while. Mm-hmm. Like, he was, like, pretty pumped about it.
It's awesome. Oh, man. He's not holding back now. Like, he's just like, you know what? It's ridiculous, dude. Like, it is fucking hilarious and deep. At the same time, it's like this fucked up joke, and it's not funny, and it is at the same time, because he's coming from this very conspiratorial angle, and he's going for it, and I think it's great. It's like, just basically, Back to the Future predicts 9/11, and I'm going to show you why and how, and it's an extremely convincing argument, extremely. Yeah, you have to see it.
Okay, so is all the content going to be released for people?
He's gonna post it at some point. I don't know when.
Can you spoil some of the little things?
Sure. Yeah, you watch the there's basically what's Marty McFly's dad's name? I can't remember, but he shows up and he's hanging upside down in Back to the Future 2, and he comes in the house. And they have a television set on the wall, it's a screen, and she's going through the channels, and you see these two, like, stone lions, and then it cuts to the two towers, and then the screen is literally, like, doing a thing where it's you know how, like, old television stuff would, like, slide?
Like, flip.
It would slide down.
And right, it's like a flipping, it's almost like a slide reel kind of going through from black to video.
And so he took the guy upside down as a clue to turn the film itself upside down. And if you've turned upside down, you literally are watching the towers falling. That's what it looks like. The towers collapse. It creates this effect. But then he's like, okay, why the two towers in the shot? Because this isn't in New York. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, it's on the television set, but it's L.A., right? So, like, why are we watching this thing from New York? But then if you look in the room, there's actually this is what got me, there's a Liberty torch in the room that looks just like the fucking torch on the fucking Statue of Liberty. So you're, like, looking at a representation of New York City. And then you're watching the towers fall. And then, there's just 9/11s left and right in the original Back to the Future. It's a whole deal because, like, his film stands alone. Like, you could take it on its own terms. But his mythological whole thing with Lloyd the Christ Bearer, right? When you combine it all, it's just, like, it's such a strong fucking statement. You look at the underlying plot of Back to the Future is overtly a warning about a terrorist attack. Can I go back to warn Christopher Lloyd that these terrorists are going to show up and shoot him? That's the premise of the movie. And so the whole thing is focused around this terrorist attack. And so, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't do it anywhere near justice. You have to see it. But, like, it's really powerful. It's heavy. And I like the way he voices it. It's very
His delivery in his videos, I appreciate it. So I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah. But I am looking forward to seeing the video or hearing the video and seeing it in its entirety. How long was it, if you know off the top of your head? Was it pretty long or short?
It wasn't too long. I mean, right now. I mean, I think he's probably going to add to it. I mean, I don't know. I didn't ask him anything. I mean, eventually, I keep telling him every time I see him, I'm like, I'm looking forward to that feature film about Back to the Future with everything, you know, all put together. And like,
his production value is so good.
It is.
There's no reason he shouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, if someone can do fucking Esoteric Agenda, it's like he could do whatever he wants. I mean, based on like how he can. Yeah, that's just my opinion. But that's cool.
Yeah.
How many people presented? Like, are we talking like a dozen, couple dozen? I'm forgetting how many people made it, who didn't make it.
Shit, I'm not good at that. I don't know. A bunch of people. Scott Onstott. Like I said, I don't want to do it.
Oh, I heard. I heard his presentation was pretty interesting.
It was incredible.
All right, so Scott Onstott was pretty cool. Like, did he? Do you remember what it focused on? Did you have a chance?
It's his whole deal. Like, he just gives a walkthrough of these amazing fucking, you know, lines across the globe and everything. It's just, and yeah, I love his approach. It's awesome.
So his general commentary on like geometries and
yeah, everything, just like a real basic walkthrough. And it was the first time he'd ever done a public anything.
Oh, really?
Related to his stuff, yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah. Where was he coming from? Do you know?
I don't know. So one thing to understand about me right now is that I didn't sleep for 2 days, essentially, before Alan got here, and then Alan had accidentally taken he was trying to do a shortcut, and it ended up like doubling his fucking drive from like whatever it was, like Oregon or whatever, and like, and he had, you know, Jeremy and Melissa and. They just, it was like, he arrived, he was supposed to arrive at night on, what was it, Friday night, and then it was like Saturday, you know, like around 2 p.m. or something, he showed up, and so we stayed up as late as we could, and then I drove Jeremy to the airport to go back to France in the morning, fucking early, and so, and I haven't, slept since, so I'm just like in a super spacey place, and so it might not be ideal for a show, but I was just so fucking excited over the stuff that I've been looking at. I was just like, I want to tell someone about this because this is fucking crazy. So so that's like, and I, you know, I like talking about the trip, but it's just like, I don't even fucking know where to start, really. It was just so much information, so much communication, with the presentations, and then in between, it's just like talk about crazy shit with like some of my favorite people. And yeah, everyone was amazing.
No, that's okay. I think it's just good to know generally, like, you know, how it went for you, and we have a general picture of it. And I know Alan and Doug and Andros, I think, had a show which I listened to part of, and so I got a hint of, you know, how things went, and people can refer to that if they really want an overview. But I just want to know what your experience was like, and it sounds like it was
awesome.
Enjoyable time for everybody. Yeah, it's like I regret not being there, but maybe next year it'll be closer to where I am, and I'll have some money. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, the money part, yeah, I know.
Dude, travel is like, you know, it's tough. But what are you going to do? I mean, Alan's been on the fucking road forever. I'm like, wow. I'm impressed. He's like, he's still standing.
I don't know how he fucking does it. That guy's a rock star, dude. For real. I don't know.
I really don't. I couldn't do it. I mean, maybe I could. And if I was pushed, I guess humans are capable of intense things, but I don't know. That's a lot of driving. It's a lot of being away from home. It's a lot of this and that.
Yeah, well, he was looking to move to the West Coast, and he still is, but he has to go back and save up some money before that's going to be a possibility for him. And so he didn't realize quite how much he was going to be, how much this was going to cost him. So,
dude, California is crazy, isn't it, generally speaking, how expensive it is to live there?
Yeah, I mean, living costs can be pretty ridiculous. Yeah, it's true.
I mean, I get people get paid more, but still,
sometimes
it's high.
Kind of.
It's high.
I don't get paid more.
Okay, it's like, man, oh man. Property values, it's like gentrification is so intense. Anyway, yeah, I don't know. I'm just like trying to catch up on some reading and whatnot. So information theory has, I guess, been on my mind, if you want to get trippy. That, if anyone really wants like a mind fuck, read something about information theory and see if you can understand it, because it's like really weird. Like science, what passes for science nowadays is really strange. I love it though. Like I can't believe more people don't embrace Bohm with how clear he is about his like esoterics, if you want to call it that.
Sure.
It's crazy because like I'm reading this and it's like the quote unquote cutting edge, and it is in ways, and I like it, but man, if we're really going to have to jump like a metaphysical boundary and like take something for granted, I think his perception or his view or his theory is like one of the best to jump to, because the others are just such stretches.
Well, yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, with Bohm, he's not coming out with his conclusion first and then backing it up. He's been led to his ideas through, like, step by step, like, where does this want to lead me? It led him there. He didn't lead it there. And it's obvious when you read him that that's how it happened. Because you can see it, because he does the walkthrough, and the walkthrough isn't backwards. Do you know what I'm saying? Like that seems to be like one of the main issues with science today, is that it's not like you have a hypothesis, sure, and you test that hypothesis. I mean, that's what you do, but they have like they're very attached to what outcome they're trying to reach, and so that's a problem. And, like, I come across that all the time in what I'm doing. I'm not very scientific a lot of the time because I see the piece that, and then I'm tying everything back towards that. But it's like you can make anything lead to where you want it to lead if you try hard enough. I don't get the sense from him that he's trying to lead it anywhere. He's just, like, following the fucking rabbit hole, and this is where it's going, and that's what that is, you know?
Right. He has no preconceptions about like what he wants. Here's the thing. He did have a metaphysics. I don't want to say he didn't. He was influenced by like working with plasma, where he saw both the cooperative and the individual kind of coexisting. And so that piqued his interest into these larger, you know, how does the universe both cooperate as a whole and I guess induce this kind of top-down causality, and how does the individual like play a part in that larger functioning without, I guess, being overlooked or made negligible. So he was always driven by that, but he was never looking for a specific form or anything. And like you said, the way he went about deriving his theory was actually very traditional and very mechanical. Actually, he just played with what's called the Schrodinger equation,
right?
And it's just like the wave equation. It describes how a particle is a wave before we observe it, and it's just a probability distribution. But Bohm took it, broke it apart, and there in his papers prove that he did it in a very, he followed all the rules. There's nothing he did that was fundamentally flawed, and no one can argue on that ground. Like, they held a conference on Bohm in the 50s, and they said, well, we can't prove him wrong, so we'll just ignore him. They really committed to just ignoring him. And he was like John Bell, or yeah, it was John Bell, John Stuart Bell. Mm-hmm. He was a really big proponent of Bohm's theory. And unfortunately, he passed away in like the early 80s. So not many people ever like pushed it forward, but he was the basically the person that found out that reality is non-local at a fundamental level, like nothing is local, or nothing is isolated, I should say. There's other things that suggest that. There's other theories and other sciences like chaos theory or systems theory that suggest that, but it's shown by entanglement and what have you and what's suggested by that. So that's, you know, he was behind it, like, and he probably would have won the Nobel Prize, and it's like, who knows how quantum physics might have developed if, like, we had this conception, because it's like, I don't think it's a sin to apply our everyday, at least some semblance of, like, what we view in the world to, like, a lower form of reality.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I don't think it's naive. I really don't think it's naive.
I have to admit, with wholeness and the implicit order, I don't understand 70 to 80% of that fucking book. And what I did understand, I was like, okay, far out. But like, I'm not a physics person, you know. Thought as a system, I could get into that. On dialogue, those kind of books, on creativity, there was nothing in there I didn't understand. But when you get into these equations and stuff, I can't follow it. At one point, I probably could have done it better, but I just loaned out, actually, to a friend of mine who's a biologist, that book, because I was just like, you know, she's really into physics, and I was like, you want to read some good physics, check this out.
Which, is that Wholeness in the Implicate Order?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've read The Undivided Universe, which is probably like his, I guess, toughest layman book, even though it's not really for layman, but it's heavy on the equations, but it's also like there's enough general language that you can piece it together. And I read that. That was really actually fun, but tough. And like a lot of the equations don't make any sense. And it, they don't need to, because they always say what their argument is when you read close enough. It's like they're just making an argument with math. They're like, it's like two monkeys going up to each other and like puffing out their chests. This is like what mathematics and science is for me. It's like intellectual territorialism, and mathematics is how they express themselves, like their dominance to each other. So if you don't express your ideas through mathematics, like it's looked upon with derision. So all the mathematics is doing is saying to other mathematicians, hey, this is like not incompetent.
Right.
But the ideas are always there if you look close enough. And so that's what I do. I just dig through stuff I don't understand to like what I know is there. If you know, I guess, how to read, but it's like takes effort and it takes a long time. And it's like depends on what your other attention is on. And it's like, who has the fucking time, really?
Right.
For a lot of this stuff. But hey, his more general books are incredibly interesting. And just like, Science, Order, and Creativity is like one of the best books. He co-wrote that with David Peet. And I think I've said that it's like brilliant before, but I'll just say it again that everyone should read it.
Oh, I never heard of that one.
Yeah, that's where he really breaks down like his process for how he derived or came to his ideas about like how the implicate order works and how everything is like, you know, a hollow movement and what the hell does that mean. And basically he saw everything as like waves, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, hey, you don't give yourself enough credit. I mean, you say you don't know anything, but like very few people can say anything about Einstein or relativity, let alone like know what or make any reference to like a metric tensor or something, you know, or know what the geodesics of space are. So I've heard you like at least toss around analogies to those things at the very least. So you have some grasp of that. And relativity is kind of like passé, I guess, in the scientific world, funny enough. It's like passé.
Well, I mean, I like just, you know, there wasn't anything that got said in any of the talks at the Sync Summit that wasn't really incredibly straightforward. There was no point where I was like, oh, this is over my head. And that's nice because it's accessible, you know, and it's the same kind of stuff because it's the implications of Bohm's work you can see being expressed by a lot of the presenters. So like, you know, Marty Leeds, you know, and then you have like the, just relaying a spiritual experience by, Swami Ajiri. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but, he wrote the, Yoga Gospel of Thomas from Sync Book, you know, And he did a great presentation. And we meditated together. And it just went in this whole, like, and which was perfect because there was this talk. And then it was like silence for a while. And it was really good.